WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. When a couple welcomes their new baby into the world, they usually vow to be the best parents possible by providing a nurturing, stimulating environment. They've probably bought a library of baby books about child-rearing do's and don'ts, believing that everything they do makes a difference. My guest, Dean Hamer, says while parents may exert some influence over their children's personalities, genes may play as significant a role. Hamer is the chief of gene structure and regulation at the National Cancer Institute's Laboratory of Biochemistry and has been doing research on the link between styles of personality and human DNA. His new book, Living with Our Genes, looks at a range of traits including thrill-seeking, depression, and worry. By taking blood samples and correlating them to psychological tests, Hamer says he found a genetic link to these behaviors. Dean Hamer got a lot of attention with his research into the so-called gay gene, which he wrote about in his 1994 book, The Science of Desire. There's a lot of interesting gene research that's currently being done, and there's a lot of hype about genes making people behave in specific ways. I asked Dean Hamer if genes are destiny.
Genes are not destiny. Just like the blueprint of a building doesn't tell you exactly how the building is going to turn out or how that building is going to be used, genes are only a rough guide for the formation of the body and of the brain.
And are your genes almost like mine?
I can say that your genes and my genes are probably 99.9% similar. That's why we're both human beings. But there is a difference about one out of every 1,000 bases, and those differences are enough to make big differences. For example, in the fact that you're female and I'm male, that you're who you are and that I'm who I am.
From the research that you have done, do you see your own heredity at work, your own genes at work in your personality?
You know, it's interesting. I used to always look at my own DNA. I was the first DNA, human DNA sample I ever made was from myself. But I stopped doing that a couple of years ago because I realized that when I learned about my genes, I also got information about my parents and my sisters that, as it turns out, they didn't really want to have revealed. And so I don't look at my own DNA anymore, but I imagine I probably have the gene for novelty seeking because what I'm working on is pretty new. Mm-hmm. I probably don't have the gene for anxiety. I don't think somebody who is very anxious would do this type of research, but those are just guesses.
What made you want to look at your own DNA to begin with?
I was the easiest person to get a blood sample from.
It was a practical solution, yes?
Right. No one could complain that, you know, I was doing something that they didn't want done.
But did you approach this with any degree of trepidation, looking at your own DNA?
You know, it's interesting. 5 years ago, I didn't really even stop to think about that. And 5 years ago, we didn't know any genes that were involved in behavior. That's changed recently. For example, now there is a gene very well identified that greatly increases the risk for Alzheimer's disease. We know that gene. We can assay it. I personally wouldn't want to know if I have that gene because, of course, at this point, there's nothing that you can do about Alzheimer's disease. So it would be interesting information, but I think not useful and possibly even dangerous or damaging information for me to know.
Well, I would think another challenge for this kind of work is to figure out this nature-nurture question, which is how do you separate out a family environment, how a parent relates to a child, whether some big trauma happened in a person's life, and what impact that might have on their genes. How do you wrestle with those questions?
Well, of course, we're interested mostly in the nature side because we're geneticists, but nurture also is very important. We know that environment is at least 50% of most behavioral traits. The way we separate that out is that we look, for example, at brothers and sisters that were raised up in the same family, have pretty much the same environment, and see within that context whether the genes have an effect. If they do, then there must be something that the genes were affecting that can't be explained by the environment.
You say that the shared environment that people have, and this would be their home environment or their school environment or their social class, really has little impact on personality. And I would think that developmental psychologists and parents would argue with you about that.
Well, this has been a really big surprise of this research, is how little the shared environment, like school system, really matters by the time a person develops into an adult. For example, if you look at something like body weight, which is controlled by eating habits, and you look at children that have been adopted, they have the same body weight as their biological parents and a completely different body weight than the adoptive parents. In fact, what happens is that when somewhat overweight parents adopt a child, the child on average will get an even lower weight, perhaps because the parents are concerned about the eating habits. So at first this seems counterintuitive. Actually, if you ask parents that have had two or more children, I think that they will probably realize more and more that what they do with the kid is not so important as who the kid is. And that really starts at birth.
But you're not saying that it doesn't matter how you treat your child or whether you yell at them or speak to them in a careful voice about something that they have done that's been wrong or bad.
There's no doubt that parenting is important. And I think you were referring to, let's say, antisocial behavior, being a juvenile delinquent, acting out at school. Some very interesting studies have shown that that type of behavior really is a combination of genes and environment. Kids who come with genes, bad genes, let's call them, genes that tend towards antisocial tendencies, do fine if they're adopted into a household where the parents do well and treat the kids well and are loving and supportive. If those same children, however, get adopted into a household where the parents are not so supportive, where there are problems in the family, then there are greatly increased risks for troublesome behaviors.
Dean Hamer is the co-author of Living with Our Genes. We'll talk more after a short break about the link between DNA and human personality. This is Fresh Air. Dean Hamer is our guest, and his book is called Living with Our Genes. Let me talk to you a little bit about the research that you've done looking at thrill-seeking and anxiety. But again, if we're talking about teasing out a certain personality trait, it seems to me that dealing with the body, you're talking about 100,000 genes, you're talking about biology and experience, that there is this synergistic relationship between all these variables.
There is a tremendously complex relationship between different personality traits, between the personality traits and actual behavior, between environment and the traits, between all of these different genes. And so what's really astounding is that we can now pinpoint individual genes that at least play some role in that complex intermixture.
Well, let's talk about thrill-seeking, and this is something that you write about in your book. How would you describe thrill-seekers?
Well, thrill-seeking is a measure of people's interest in novel stimuli, and if I wanted to ask you one question to figure out whether or not you were a novelty seeker,
okay,
I might ask you, if you're in a new country where you've never been before, and it's lunchtime and you're hungry and you're walking down the street, on one side you see McDonald's, and on the other side, you see a little shack selling a local delicacy, fried goat testicles, for example. Where would you go for lunch?
Well, I would have to pause there because I'm not sure about the goat testicles. But I sure would be tempted to try out that new place. But
Well, you may then have the gene for novelty seeking.
All right. I mean, it wouldn't be a beeline over there. I'd have to think.
Well, you may also have a gene for anxiety, which inhibits you a little bit. And that's a good thing.
Because it can be dangerous to be thrill-seeker.
Exactly. Thrill-seekers like exciting activities like bungee jumping or skydiving or extreme skiing. They also may like intellectually exciting activities like abstract art or trying out transcendental meditation. But they can also like things that aren't necessarily so good, like experimenting with new drugs, having multiple sexual partners, gambling, and so on.
Okay, so we have this personality type, this novelty seeker, this thrill seeker. How did you then do the science which makes then this connection to some kind of genetic marker?
Well, we knew that the brain chemical that's responsible for feeling good in response to new stimuli is a chemical called dopamine, and it's sort of the brain's pleasure chemical. Dopamine is what makes people feel good if they've had a delicious meal, if they've smoked a cigarette or had a hit of cocaine, or if they've had a new sexual experience. And so we wondered whether there was some connection between this pleasure chemical dopamine and people's levels of novelty seeking. To look at that, we looked at a molecule called the dopamine receptor. It's the lock into which dopamine fits as the key. And we found out people have different types of dopamine receptor genes. Some people have a form that's turned on by dopamine in response to new stimuli. Other people have a form that's not turned on. So some people get a thrill out of new things. Some people go bungee jumping and it makes them feel good, and that's because they have this form of the dopamine receptor. Other people can do the same experience. They don't feel so good, in part because they have a different dopamine receptor.
Are you saying then it's not the gene that makes you seek the novelty? It's the fact that the dopamine makes you feel good if you do engage in these thrill-seeking behaviors?
Exactly. The gene just makes a protein that controls how well dopamine makes you feel. So it's not like the gene is whispering into your ear, jump off this cliff or go see the yoga. The gene is just making a protein that controls how good you feel, how rewarded you feel in response to a new stimulus.
Well, another trait that you looked at, and perhaps it's almost the opposite of thrill-seeking, has to do with worry or anxiety. And you describe this as, excuse me, as a trait with deep biological roots. How come?
Psychologists have shown that the roots of anxiety and worry can be traced to children even before they are born. And that by the time children are a year or so old, that there's a real division between those who are worried, anxious, fretful, cry a lot, don't like to leave mommy's side, and those who are more peaceful, pacific, they make cruel and giggle, they smile at strangers. And that trait really lasts throughout a lifetime. Children that were fretful and worried grow up to be adults who, on average, are a little bit more neurotic, depressed, and worried. And children who were calm and happy are more likely to grow up to be extroverted, sociable sorts of adults.
Are you saying then that worry runs in families because of genetics, or could it be that this is an anxious and slightly depressed family that then, you know, creates an atmosphere of worry?
Well, certainly worry, anxiety, depression does run in families. The Hemingway family with multiple suicides and deaths is a classic example of that. It's probably a combination of upbringing and of genes, but our research suggests that genes are the most important of those factors. Even children that are adopted into new households with new parents who may be very cheerful still show the depressive or neurotic qualities of their biological parents.
What then is the chemical or genetic then link? Where did you go to look to try to find that link associated with worry?
Well, the key chemical for worry is called serotonin. It's sort of dopamine's evil twin. Serotonin is what makes you feel bad, what right. makes you feel anxious and depressed. And the big clue in this research was from a very popular drug called Prozac. Prozac, of course, is an antidepressant. It's also used to treat people that feel anxiety, that feel hostility, that feel pessimism. And Prozac acts directly on serotonin. It changes the levels of free serotonin by interacting with a protein called the serotonin transporter. So we wondered whether or not people would have a difference in the gene for the serotonin transporter. Would there be a sort of natural genetic Prozac that people are born with? And we looked at that gene real carefully, and we found out that there is a difference. Some people have a form of the gene that's like a natural Prozac. It's as if from conception they had been taking Prozac. Other people have a form of the gene that doesn't work so well, and it's like they're not on Prozac.
Well, let me ask you a sixth grade science question. What literally does that look like?
What that looks like is that at one point in this gene, your sequence might read AGG, AGG, but mine reads AGG, AGG, AGG. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a musical tune that's repeated over and over, but sometimes some people forget a stanza. They only repeat it three times instead of four times or four instead of five.
And you can definitively say that that variability is tied then into these specific behaviors that we've been talking about.
Well, we looked at people with the different forms of the gene, and we found that people with the Prozac form of the gene, if you will, had lower levels of anxiety, lower levels of depression, lower levels of pessimism. They were also less aggressive, less hostile. They looked like people that were on Prozac. It wasn't an absolute effect. There are people who are depressed who have the good form of the gene. There are people who are have the bad form of the gene who are perfectly happy. But there's a strong correlation.
We're talking with Dean Hamer, and his book is called Living with Our Genes. He's chief of gene structure and regulation at the National Cancer Institute's Laboratory of Biochemistry. Well, let's talk about sex and reproduction,
all
which
right,
of course you describe as you know one of the most powerful human drives, and of course it has to do with our survival. When you look at men and women and sex and reproduction, what kinds of differences do you find?
Well, as they say, men are from Venus and women are from Mars, or perhaps it's the other way around. And some people think that's all because of the way we portray men and women in TVs and radio and magazines and so on. But there's actually a strong evolutionary difference for many of the differences between men and women. And that is that men's genes do best by acting as if the men were sperm. There are a lot of them. They're abundant. They only have a few chances to reproduce. And so they want to have sex with as many partners as possible, as frequently as possible. And women will tend to act in behalf of their eggs, which are rare, which are valuable. They have to really think about things or consider things before they make a reproductive decision. And so there's more likely to be a desire for partners that can provide resources that will stick around for the care of the child. And that translates into some of the behaviors that are very different between men and women.
So we're back to the stereotypes of men and women. She wants a guy with a big wallet, and he wants a woman with big breasts.
You said it.
This is as far as we've come in terms of evolution, right?
Well, one of the differences that people have always said, oh, that's biological or that's genetic, or they've said, oh, that's completely cultural, that's because of stereotypes. We're now able to trace a few genes that are directly involved in those different sexual behaviors.
Now, as you describe men, and you said men behave like sperm, which is that they are interested in many partners and interested in a lot of sex. I mean, it sounds like men then are novelty seekers.
Well, men are novelty seekers, and some more so than other. One of the fascinating connections we found between genes and sex is in the gene for the dopamine receptor. Some people have a form that make them eager to experience novel stimuli. Other people have a form of the gene that makes them less interested in new stimuli. And that translates into interest in new sexual partners. Men who are high novelty seekers are more likely to seek out a variety of partners and also unusual partners. For example, heterosexual men may sleep with another guy just for a new experience, or gay men may sleep with a woman just for a new experience.
You say looking at female sexuality and even sexual orientation, that is less genetic or biologically based and more culturally and environmentally influenced. Explain what you're saying there.
Well, I think people have realized for a long time that women's sexuality is a bit more flexible, less hardwired than it is for men. Women are more likely to change their orientation over time. They're more likely to have mixed interest. And now genetic and twin experiments have shown that that's in part because genes are less important for determining a woman's sexuality and sexual orientation than the genes are for men.
Well, how do we know that?
The way that we know that is that if you look at identical twins and one of them is a gay male, his identical twin will have about a 50% chance of also being gay, much higher than in the general population and much higher than in fraternal twins. And that means that genes are important of male sexual orientation. When that same experiment was done with women, a very different answer emerged. Both the identical and fraternal twins had the same chance of identifying as lesbian. And if the two twins were raised up separately in different households, then there wasn't any relationship at all. So that says that genes are less important for female sexual orientation, and that something else, perhaps something in the environment, perhaps something in the culture, is playing more of a role in women.
Do you think there's an evolutionary explanation for that?
The classic evolutionary explanation is that you only need one sex of the two to be interested in sex. And in the human species and in other mammals and higher species, that appears to be males.
Dean Hamer is the chief of gene structure and regulation at the National Cancer Institute's Laboratory of Biochemistry and co-author of Living with Our Genes. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Well, again, our guest on Fresh Air today is Dean Hamer. We're talking about genes. It's the topic of his book. It's called Living with Our Genes. Let me go back a couple of years to the discovery of the so-called gay gene. And this was based on some research that you did looking at brothers and finding some kind of correlation between genetic markers and homosexuality. You got criticized for that, and I guess criticized that the research that you did was too narrow. Do you think that was a fair criticism?
I think any research on human sexuality is going to be criticized no matter what the results are, because it's such a controversial and such a personal topic as well. The results on male sexual orientation have held up, and we haven't discovered the gene yet, but my own laboratory and others are looking very hard for it. And once we have that information, we'll have some, you know, real knowledge about the connection between genes and sexuality.
Why are you interested in this particular topic?
Well, there's a good biological reason, which is that sex is the driving force for all of evolution. Understanding the basic mechanisms, the genetic mechanisms, the brain mechanisms that cause sexuality is very important. We actually started that research for another reason, which was to look at HIV and AIDS and a particular outcome of AIDS called Kaposi's sarcoma. I think that it's practically important that we do more research on human sexuality, try to understand why people behave the way they do, especially in the era of AIDS, where sexual behavior has become such an important health factor.
So you were looking at brothers?
We looked at families where there were two gay brothers, and we asked the question, is there any genetic peculiarity or similarity between them? Found a gene region on the X chromosome, which is one of the sex chromosomes, that correlated with sexual orientation. It's not an on-off switch for homosexuality, but it does play some role.
So you found a region and not a gay gene, because, of course, the headlines were a gay gene.
Well, you people in the media simplify things sometimes. It's not actually a gene at this point. It is a region, a big chunk of the chromosome, a region that could contain about 500 different genes. And now the search is on to narrow that down to find the needle in the haystack.
Although I think the subtitle of your book about it had something about the gay gene. To defend the press here.
In quotes, yes.
In quotes. And looking at a connection between genes and homosexuality, what does that say about everyone else's sexuality, looking at heterosexuality?
Oh, sure. Sometimes people think that there is a gay gene and that if you have that gene, you're gay, and that people that don't have that gene at all are heterosexual. But actually, that's really not right. There's probably asexual orientation gene or many sexual orientation genes. And it can come in different varieties. It can come in a gay variety, but most of the time it comes in a straight variety. And we are actually able to show by looking at gays and their heterosexual brothers that the same gene region is involved in heterosexuality. So this isn't really a gay gene. It's an orientation gene that comes in different varieties.
If we're talking about a gene that defines sexual orientation, we'll say homosexuality, are you concerned that if that's found, that then there will be some kind of a screening test to screen out these potential children in utero?
I think that that would be unethical. I think it would be wrong. I think it should be legislated against. Fortunately, it's not going to actually happen because we already know that this gene only has a modest influence on sexual orientation, that just by looking at a blood sample or a DNA sample, one could not definitively predict the sexual orientation of a child. So not only would it be unethical, it would be scientifically unsound as well.
I wonder, too, as people begin to think more about genes, their own genes, I guess, and everybody else's, whether we'll begin to medicalize human variability, that we'll look at what perhaps makes someone interesting and idiosyncratic. We'll begin to look at it in a kind of in a medical way, in a way that they've got a problem as opposed to, gosh, they're interesting.
I think what will happen is that for a relatively short period of time, there will be some medicalization and that normal variations in behavior will be seen as some sort of extensions of pathology. But what will happen within a decade or so is that we'll quickly realize that everybody has a whole bunch of, quote, bad or, quote, good genes, that we are all a little bit crazy, that we are all a little bit sick, that we all have the potential for this disease or that disease, that we'll all die eventually. and that as that is recognized, there will be less stigmatization, and we'll return to a sort of a more normal view.
Do you think, though, that this will create the drugs to deal with anxiety, I mean, even beyond Prozac? I guess to some degree we're already doing that, but drugs to deal with thrill-seeking or cigarette smoking and other issues?
Well, I think the first development will actually be in diagnosis rather than in new drugs. For example, now when somebody goes to a psychiatrist and says, I feel really lousy, I can't get out of bed, I don't want to eat, the psychiatrist says, aha, your diagnosis is depression, mm-hmm. which isn't really a diagnosis at all. It's just saying that you're showing all the signs of depression that other people show. Some point in the future, the doctor will be able to listen to all of that, which will be important, but also look at the person's DNA and say, ah, you have this sort of depression that's because you have bad serotonin transmission. Or the doctor may look and say, you have depression, but you don't have any problem with your serotonin. Let's talk about your life a little bit more and about what's going on with you. So I think that'll be the first and a very important development.
Well, Dean Hamer, thank you very much for joining us. A very interesting discussion. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Marty.
Dean Hamer is the co-author of Living with Our Genes.